and brothers, this is Reverend Satchmo getting ready to beat out this mellow sermon for you. My text this evening is when the saints go marching in. Here come Brother Hickenbottom down the aisle with his trombone. Blow it, boy.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can review this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is Iraqi Mass Deception and U.S. Moral Panic. In this program, Peter B. Collins interviews Scott A. Bond. In the book, Mass Deception, Scott A. Bond connects propaganda and distortion by the Bush administration to elite deviance and state crime and violations of international criminal law. Dr. Bond's book illustrates just how simple it is for those in the highest seats of power to deceive and manipulate ordinary, hard-working, trusting Americans into losing sight of what the truth really is and coercing them into sending their sons and daughters needlessly into harm's way. Warning, loyal Republicans may find some parts of this program difficult to understand.
And Scott, you map this out in statistical detail, and essentially you try to take a period of time and evaluate the rhetoric, the language, and the information or propaganda that was being projected at that point. And then you tried to follow its impact in the polls in the immediate period after the delivery of these information packages, if we call them that.
Exactly, yes. And fortunately, for the sake of my analysis, The Gallup organization actually took the temperature of the public, if you will, on 24 separate occasions leading up to the Iraq War after 9/11, and that allowed me, within each one of those 24 intervals, to take a look at the impact of the rhetoric that led up to each one of those public opinion polls. And each time they did it, they asked the same question to, of the public. Are you either in favor of or opposed to removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq with military force? So I was able to compare one to the other. Mm-hmm. And that's how I was able to determine the consensus of the public. And once again, the public opinion mirrored the dissemination of the rhetoric by the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then hostility, which is the third component of a moral panic or third criteria, is manifested just in the inflammatory nature of the rhetoric toward Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Yeah, you know, they're clearly being demonized. They're being demonized as evildoers and madmen and simply in the rhetoric itself and the tone of the rhetoric. You can hear it in their voices and the hostility in the tone of the rhetoric.
And that ranged from the allegations repeated over and over again that Saddam had used poison gas on his own people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we never referenced that we supplied some of that gas in the era when he was at war with Iran in the 1980s, and that Donald Rumsfeld himself made a trip to Baghdad circa 1984 to let him know that any public comments that objected to his use of weaponized gas against the Iranians should be taken lightly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. And the fourth criteria, which is disproportionality, is a measurement of the extent to which the threat is real. And sometimes this can be done after the fact, when we realize now that there was absolutely no threat whatsoever, so we were being told that in fact if we didn't take action, there could be mushroom clouds and a smoking gun that would be to bear. So, you know, essentially we were being told that you know, there are dire consequences if we didn't take immediate action against Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
So it's disproportionate to the extent that we were being led to believe that this was a truly dire situation, when in fact the very weapons that we were being told that Iraq had, they didn't have at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final criteria, and this one's actually really kind of interesting, is the volatility. And the notion here is that public opinion and fear and concern is not just a direct red line. It's not just it doesn't just climb consistently, directly, and without any break. There tends to be an ebb and flow in both the rhetoric as well as the concern itself. There are peaks and valleys along the way, and in a typical moral panic situation. And that's exactly what I found. Bush, the rhetoric that started almost immediately after 9/11 toward Iraq, didn't just climb consistently for the next year and a half until the invasion. There were ebbs and flows, and the public concern and the willingness to go to war actually reflected that. So essentially, the five criteria that Stan Cohen outlined as being requirements for a moral panic were filled in this case.
Mm-hmm. And Scott Bond, as you look at this, did they know what they were doing? Are you, kind of reverse engineering a framework around what they did on an ad hoc basis? Or were they conscious and consulting with, psychologists and propaganda experts on the best way to execute this?
What a great question, Peter. I'm glad you asked me this, because there was an interesting thing that happened that I uncovered while I was doing my research. And as I was looking for the public opinion polls that would allow me to conduct the kind of analysis that I wanted to do, I ended up with Gallup, because they consistently asked these questions over time. But even more interestingly, the first time that they asked the American public, the Gallup organization, the first time they asked the question, do you favor or oppose going to war, was asked 2 weeks after Bush took office in 2001. It was asked the beginning of February of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
They had never asked it before during the Clinton administration, and it was then not asked again until immediately after September 11th, so 8 months later. So what's powerful here, I think, is it gave me, first of all, a measure of public opinion before 9/11,
right.
But it also begs the question, why did they ask the question at all 2 weeks after Bush took office?
Well, they must have heard from Paul O'Neill. He was the Treasury Secretary who got bounced and wrote a book explaining that at the very first cabinet meeting toward the end of January of 2001, that it was announced that, mm-hmm. that we're planning a war against Iraq.
Yep. Well, and he's not the only one. Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff,
mm-hmm.
Scott McClellan,
yeah.
they both of those gentlemen now say that absolutely Bush was obsessed with Iraq long before September 11th.
Mm-hmm. Now let's listen to a soundbite. This one is Colin Powell, and it's chilling to me, Scott, because I guess I've always let him off the hook. I thought he was the better of the bad guys in the Bush administration. But when you go back, and despite his internal resistance, the speech that he gave at the United Nations in February of 2003, when he held up that little vial,
mm-hmm.
The language that he used that was distributed from the White House, these talking points, he picked up and he delivered them. And so I regard him as quite complicit. He seems to have the most conscience about it of those who served in that administration. But I can't exonerate him for having second thoughts or doubts afterward. Let's listen to Powell. And the voice you'll hear critiquing his comment is former U.S. Marine and U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter.
Saddam Hussein has used these horrific weapons on another country and on his own people.
Colin Powell spoke of thousands of liters of anthrax that were unaccounted for, and he said they're probably hiding it. And then he held up a little vial of white powder, and he said a couple teaspoonfuls of white powder like this, if launched against American cities, could kill thousands of Americans. If he was truly to reflect the Iraqi capability, he would have held up a bottle of Diet Coke and said the Iraqis produced anthrax that looked like this. It has a shelf life of 3 years. The last known production batch came out in 1991, so even if Iraq was hiding this brown sludge liquid, it would be useless today.
And that really was one of the most powerful voices who I talked with, Scott, prior to our invasion of Iraq. And I will always be proud of the courage of Scott Ritter. I'm sad to say that in recent years, he got caught up in an internet underage sex scandal. And I feel sad for him on that. But I've met him on several occasions. We shared a stage together talking about these issues. And he showed incredible courage against the currents of nationalism and jingoism that were so powerful during this critical period of time.
Yes. And I likewise, agree that he was a very powerful voice and been a very, very outspoken critic of the Bush administration. And, you know, you mentioned Colin Powell, and I share your thoughts there, your position on that. This is a man who had, you know, tremendous legitimacy and credibility, and which has now, of course, all gone out the window. And if he had to do things over again, he might well choose to do things differently. But he was the essentially the bag man and put the final nail in the coffin of Iraq there in February of 2003 when he delivered that famous speech to the UN, as you alluded to. The title of it was Iraq Fails to Disarm. And if you recall, it was largely animated, and including these little trucks driving around that were allegedly biological weapon labs.
Yes, the curveball PowerPoints.
And do you remember what it turned out those little animated trucks were when they got over to Iraq?
They held balloons that were, you know, or dirigibles that were used for surveillance, right?
Weather stations, mobile weather stations, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So Colin Powell certainly had some egg on his face over that one. But
you also mentioned his chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, and he has been quite outspoken, very critical of the Bush administration, and even somewhat critical of Obama's military policies. And to what extent do you believe that he coordinates those comments with the former Secretary of State? And to what extent is Powell hoping that Wilkerson's comments will ameliorate my hardened view of Colin Powell?
I believe that he's almost a surrogate voice. Certainly Colin Powell has not in any way attempted to quell or silence Wilkerson. He has not criticized him in any way, or at least any forum that I'm aware of. And I've always believed that that Wilkerson was almost a proxy for Colin Powell. I'm talking about after the fact now, in terms of telling the truth and what was going on. And Wilkerson has said definitive terms that Bush was obsessed from day one with removing Saddam Hussein from Iraq, and that all 9/11 did was provide the window of opportunity to do it. And he's been very, very emphatic, along with people like Ramsey Clark and Scott Ritter that you mentioned and others, that the Bush administration committed war crimes, and they knew that they were doing it, and it just didn't matter. And they sought to get the UN Security Council authorization, and when they failed to get it to go to war, they simply said they didn't need it.
Yeah, I remember that vividly. Now let's listen to Condoleezza Rice backpedaling. She was, of course, the National Security Advisor during the first Bush term, and failed so badly that she was promoted to Secretary of State when they pushed Colin Powell out for being insufficiently compliant.
Mm-hmm.
And here we hear her trying to explain away the non-existent weapons of mass destruction.
The president quoted a British paper. We did not know at the time. No one knew at the time in our circles. Maybe someone knew down in the bowels of the agency, but no one in our circles knew that there were doubts and suspicions that this might be a forgery. Of course, it was information that was mistaken.
Now, this is a flat-out lie.
That's right.
Because we know that there was a high-ranking Iraqi defector who was questioned in the months before we invaded Iraq, who made it very clear that the whole effort to depict an ongoing weapons program in Iraq, whether nuclear or biological, was a myth that was being used in a defensive manner, that this was being projected to try to keep the United States from invading, to try to blow up, and this reminds me of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Boris Badenov, where Boris Badenov is this tiny little cartoon character, and he uses a big flashlight to project his image on a wall to make him look big and menacing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the metaphor that I would use for the way Saddam was trying to posture as a military threat. And he was trying to prevent a future military conflict, whether it was an invasion by the U.S., continuation of the sanctions, or some middle ground where we might bomb without invading.
Yes, and as far as the evidence that you're talking about, Ron Suskind wrote about that in his book, The Way of the World. I don't know if you've read that, but a terrific book about these same issues. And Condoleezza Rice was just spouting an absolute lie there. And they knew that they were just committed to it, and they were determined to go to war regardless of the consequences and regardless of any facts that might seem to refute their argument.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just do whatever was necessary to discount those facts or discredit those facts. And as a matter of fact, much of the evidence that was used against Iraq came from the non-credible source of Ahmed Chalabi. Remember
mm-hmm.
him?
Sure. He was getting $300,000 a month from
the
Pentagon.
Exactly, from Dick
Cheney. Yeah. Right.
Gee, we're paying for the evidence because we don't like what we're getting from our own intelligence agencies. If the evidence wouldn't add up the way they wanted it, they made up their own.
Mm-hmm.
And this absolutely was contrived. And the Bush's claim now that I don't know if you remember from the interview with Matt Lauer, the one question that seemed like we might really get somewhere and it would really bring about a meaningful discussion, was when he asked Bush, if you knew then what you know now, which is that there were no weapons of mass destruction, would you still go to war in Iraq? And Bush didn't answer the question. What he said instead was that by invading Iraq, he kept the United States from being being the victim of another terrorism attack. Well, in what bizarro world are we talking about? If they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, what did the war protect us from? The weapons of mass destruction that they didn't have?
Come on, Scott, we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here.
Exactly.
I mean, we laugh at that line. It's comical, but a lot of people bought that. They said, well, you know, there weren't any weapons, and you know, but Saddam was a bad guy. They would try to settle for a second or third best explanation after acknowledging, and here we have the president himself. This is a very quick one, so listen carefully.
We've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
So he finally admitted no connection between Saddam and 9/11, and I think that we can safely widen that out to that he knew there was absolutely no connection between Saddam and al-Qaeda. Not until we invaded Iraq and created an opportunity for, you know, characters like, what was his name with the Z? No, I'm not thinking of Zubaydah. Zarqawi.
Oh, yeah.
Zarqawi was not in Iraq at the time that we made the claim of a connection between Saddam and 9/11.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, looking back on this, when you look at these things in retrospect, it's so easy to pick them apart. And yet at the time, because the volume was just so high and it was this relentless campaign, it's easy to see why people got caught up in it. And again, the Bush administration, we have to admit, they very effectively tied this argument of an alleged threat from Iraq to the imagery of 9/11, and constantly provided these reminders of if we don't do something now, then there could be mushroom clouds, and don't forget the burning towers of the World Trade Center. So in communication research, we call it priming, and what I mean by that is they would constantly try to rekindle these sense memories and these emotions by linking Iraq to the emotions of 9/11 to trigger hostility and retaliation and these sorts of emotions. And they did it very well, clearly, because 70% of the population was ready to go to war.
One more clip. This is Donald Rumsfeld. He of the known, unknown, unknown, known, 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 known.
Think it took us 10 months to find Saddam Hussein. The reality is that the hole he was found hiding in was large enough to hold enough biological weapons to kill thousands of human beings. Our people had gone past that farm several times, had no idea he was there. And unlike Saddam Hussein, such objects, once buried, can stay buried. In a country the size of California, the chances of inspectors finding something buried in the ground without their being led to it by people knowledgeable about where it was is minimal.
So here he is. This is, we have to place this in late 2004 to early 2005. We have discovered Saddam, and Rumsfeld is still clinging to the discredited notion that somewhere in Iraq, and he said to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, that they've got him. We're just haven't found him yet. It's a big country.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is bizarre. He also had a public encounter with my friend Ray McGovern, who I first met through the Uncovered documentary. Ray spent 27 years at the CIA. He briefed President Reagan in the early 1980s. Not an outsider, not a pansy anti-war peacenik kind of a guy. And McGovern was at a public meeting where questions were invited for Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. He went to the microphone and politely asked him where the WMD were. And security people tried to interrupt and prevent him from completing the question. To Rumsfeld's credit, he allowed McGovern to complete the question, but then didn't answer it. And so it's amazing to me the kind of spinning that top administration officials were still involved in well after the public knew this was a canard.
Absolutely. Well, Bush is still doing it to this very day, and as well as Cheney. So they're determined. They're determined to rewrite history. And Bush has said that his memoir was an attempt to clearly state reality. I would say that it's an attempt to rewrite history and to recreate reality.
Mm-hmm.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.